you can lead the way with the conversation of what you wanted to build on before a commissioner steps into the booth.
I want to build on our people are sick. When I say people, I mean human beings on earth. Every last one of us has some type of issue, and a lot of us don't know it. And I think that the majority of us say we want to stop gun violence. We want to stop the heroin epidemic. We want to stop, poverty and homelessness. We want to get aid for people with mental health issues. However, do we really? Because we're not addressing the root causes of all of those problems. You know, we talk about obesity in America. We talk about cancer. We talk about high blood pressure and strokes. But we don't talk about how the experiences that we have as children make us predisposed to all of those medical conditions. We don't talk about how what we experience in early childhood determines our cellular growth, literally, on a minute biological scale. You know, so what we dealing with is a society that has a lot of problems. And those problems are across the board in every socioeconomic class. However, they seem to have a disproportionate effect on the low income individuals, regardless of ethnicity. So that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the underlying issues. We need to stop the gun violence. How you going to stop the gun violence if you don't know why they out here shooting? Oh, man, we need to take back the community. How you going to take back the community when you don't even realize that the community is not yours? How you going to take back the community when you never had it in the first place? How you going to take back the community when you're causing or participating in the things that are detrimental to that society or that community or that neighborhood?
You know, when you know, it comes from Dr. Dennis Muhammad, peace to the peacekeepers, that made that comment about taking back. You know, when you start talking about taking back something from somebody else, that's an instant conflict. So anybody that's in any type of movement, if you start talking about we're going to take back the streets, you're going to war. So the folks that are in the streets or the people that you view as being of the streets, there's going to be an instant conflict there to where there's not going to be growth and development right there. There's going to be heads button. There's going to be a clash. There's going to be a war. So if your main focus is to uplift, you're going to have to go about it in a more uplifting type of fashion. And it's not going to be let's take back, because that's the us versus them mentality.
A lot of times we have a us versus them mentality because our whole life, that's the way it's been. Us versus them. So like, I was having a conversation earlier about ACEs and the impact it has on your life. And it was mentioned that you can't make excuses for people who do crazy stuff. Yes and no. I'm not going to make an excuse for them, but I can give you an explanation of why their brain doesn't work the way the typical person's brain would work if they hadn't experienced all those traumas. So it's not an excuse, but there are so many different factors. Like there's 10 different factors that you can base your ACE score on.
What score is that?
Your ACE, acute childhood experience score. The more negative childhood experience or childhood traumas that you've experienced will increase your risk of aggressive behavior, running off at the mouth, impulse control, drug abuse, cancer, heart disease, strokes. You know, everything, asthma even. What you deal with as a child determines if you have an increase in asthma. So there's five different, well, it can determine, have an impact. I'm not going to say it always does, but it can. So if you have, there are five related to yourself and five related to your family. So if you experience physical abuse, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect, or emotional neglect, you get a point for each one of those things. The more points you get, the more severe the consequences later on in adulthood. Now, as far as the family related ones go, if you have a parent who's an alcoholic or drug addict, a mother who or father who's especially a mother, though, who's a victim of domestic violence, a family member who's been incarcerated, a family member diagnosed with a mental illness, and the disappearance of a parent through divorce or death or abandonment. So if you look at the inner city neighborhoods, you look at the middle class neighborhoods, you look at the upper class neighborhoods, they all dealing with these same situations. Just because you are low income doesn't mean that your parents get beat, whereas the rich folks don't. That's across the board. Child abuse in Kentucky is across the board. So, you know, people like to point fingers and say, well, this is why these people from this demographic act this way, when in all actuality, it explains a lot of all of our actions. You know, they say that your understanding of the world is based on the way the world is when you're 7. So, 7 is what? 3rd grade? 2nd, 3rd grade?
So,
you go to school, kindergarten's 5, 6 is 1st grade, 7, 2nd, you in 2nd grade.
That sounds a bit off, because it's September. So what does that mean, that you don't learn anything from the time you're 7 up until the time you...
Nah, you come into your you come into your personality by the time you're 7. From that time until an adult, you're just programmed on what is socially acceptable and what isn't. You may learn a few things, but your personality, you already who you are.
Okay.
You know, so your understanding of the world is, so, you know, if optimistic people, by the time they 7, for the most part, they've had positive lives. Pessimistic people, on the other hand, have experienced negative things in their life. So if you experience child abuse in your home, you witness your mother getting beat, you have a mother or a father with drug dependencies and alcohol issues and this, that, and the other. You know, they talk down to you and talk to you real, real reckless, or they just don't pay you any attention whatsoever. All of those things count as a score. And then if that's what you're dealing with at 7, you're not going to see the world as a beautiful place. So your perception of the world is going to be based on, for the most part, your understanding at that young age. So some kids have beautiful childhoods. Some kids have very, very rough childhoods. The children with the rough childhoods are the ones who have the aggressive behavior. They have the impulse control. They're more likely to be strung out on drugs. They're more likely to develop negative health issues, from obesity and asthma to cancer and heart disease. I mean, it's a lot of stuff that we're not talking about. So everybody wants to talk about this gun violence and shootings. Those are symptoms of a problem. The bigger problem is we have children who are dealing with traumatic experiences and nobody to help them work through those experiences. And that's male and female, you know, across the board. But nobody wants to talk about it. You know, a lot of people feel like, oh, it's just dumb. That's ignorant. Don't make no sense. Some people say, oh, you know, that sounds good, but nah. And I'm one of those people who, like, I disagree. Because you can look at the genetic impact that it has on your body.
So say you a 17-year-old male. And you out here setting up stings. That's a robbery for the folks out there that don't know no better. So then you set up a sting. A guy comes through. You set it up for a little or no dope at all. You know, maybe say you set it up for an ounce of weed. Things go bad, and that 17-year-old kills a 19-year-old. So now what's the play? Is it based on his childhood? Or did that boy at 17 know good and dang on well that he wasn't supposed to be one setting up stings, robbing folks? Shouldn't be trying to hustle marijuana, shouldn't be trying to sell marijuana, isn't old enough to have a gun, let alone use it in a robbery, let alone not only use it in a robbery, but use it as in a homicide for something that isn't valued at more than $500. And we're talking about $500, you know, back in the day, marijuana, weed was cheap, but them folks smoke loud. So I say $500, so where we could go top, somebody might say, oh man, I got some Asian Afghan crystal tree from the Antarctic Kush that's $1,000 an ounce, which, you know, I don't know. They put anything on top of it that they want to these days, but let's say no more than $500. Does that go back to childhood? Does that just go back to some foolish child that just don't give a dang on and don't care? Because a lot of these children come from middle-class neighborhoods. And they maybe watch some TV. They might watch some videos. They might be on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, and they won't be gangsters. So then they decide, you know, if I get a gun and I hang with a couple dudes that are from the streets and get into trouble and we all hanging out together, we can get some money together. Because for the most part, it seems like the folks from the hood, from the street, they got a little more street sense than that. So, you know, a lot of these middle class folks are the ones committing a lot of these atrocities in the city communities. They not poor. They not down and out. A lot of them are doing all right. Got a mother, a father, maybe not their biological father, but they have support systems in place, and they still choose to go left opposed to going right. So how do you break that down on the A score if they have been given a good life?
A good life is relative. First of all, I would say a good life is relative based on being on the outside looking in. I had a conversation with a dude named Anthony Jones the other day, and he said, "Man, why do you East Side?" I said, "Man, that's that old Tate's Creek stuff." He said, "Why do you East End people in Lexington always hate on Tate's Creek in Lexington? We all from the same city. Why do y'all? We all black. Why do y'all hate on us?" I said, "Man, y'all was living a good life, man. You know, East End, we struggled a little bit, and y'all didn't have that same struggle." Dude was like, "Man, you crazy." I can't remember what neighborhood he moved from out Tate's Creek, but he said basically the income didn't change. So they had to struggle the same as everybody else struggles. The perception of East End people is since they live out Tate's Creek in a nice neighborhood, they doing well, right? That's one thought. Now you got to look at it like this. Who's responsible for the child abuse in Kentucky?
Everybody, but are you talking about the higher numbers of child abuse statistically?
Statistically speaking, what does the face of child abuse in Kentucky look like?
Middle class Europeans.
All right, so if middle class white folks can have these issues, their suicide rate is sky high for a reason. Oh, ACEs, it plays in a suicide too. If you have an ACE score of, I think it's over 6, you're like 20 times more likely to commit suicide or have suicidality. So, I mean, yeah, it makes a major difference. So just because you middle class don't mean nothing. You could grow up middle class and have a dad who's verbally abusive. You can grow up middle class and have a mother or a father who has mental health issues, alcohol issues, drug issues. You know, it doesn't matter because you're middle class. You know, it doesn't. 1 in 4 females, for instance, or young girls, statistically speaking, I think they said it's 1 in 4.
So then
it's molested.
So then the question is if you come from a middle class family, how come these middle class children are ending up in the hood committing these problems?
Because
they're not in their community.
Middle class parents are very neglectful, in my subjective personal opinion.
Uh-huh.
Middle class parents have the tendency to be more neglectful than others because they have to work harder. Stay-at-home mom, she's at home. Whether she's a welfare mother, a mother, or whether she's a rich woman's, a rich wife, they sit at home with the children. The middle class got to carry the load. Middle class is working 2 jobs. Middle class is busting their butt, so a lot of time they don't have the time to dedicate to their children. Then if you look at in our communities, 74% of black children are born to single mothers. That almost guarantees poverty. So when you have the ones that aren't impoverished and the media dictates what's cool, the media dictates that this is the culture we live in, blah, blah, blah. They want to fit in. They want to belong. So it makes sense. They have a need to belong. So to meet that need to belong, they will go to the group that society and or our culture says is the coolest, the hippest, the dopest, the one that can provide the protection, that can provide the financial security and stability. So it makes sense. It just don't make no sense. You know, they can rationalize. It doesn't mean it's the right answer, but they can rationalize it to where it will make sense in their mind.
Is that what leads to the single house households, the single home households, the single parent? Is that what ACEs, or that ACE score that you were speaking about?
Women with an ACE score of 4 or below, or above are statistically more likely to have, and males and the females. If you have the higher your A score, the more likely you are to have teenage children in your teenage years. It also means that you're statistically more likely to engage in reckless sexual behavior. It means that you're statistically more likely to engage in drug use. And you say, well, that's stupid. You know, if you use drugs, that's dumb to use drugs. I feel you. Unless you look at it from this standpoint. The ACEs affects you on a biological level. Because every time you hit ACE, every time you experience your daddy whooping your mama, you go into fight or flight reflex. So your body really does the necessary requirements to prepare you to fight or take flight. Your adrenaline pumps. heart rate increases. You release dopamine. You release all kind of different chemicals. Well, if you deal with the fight or flight frequently, your body's going to release so much dopamine so frequently that it doesn't have the same effect anymore. So it takes more to make you happy on a regular day. This is on a biological level, cellular level. At the same time, you're releasing your hypothalamus, your pituitary, and your thyroid. I think all of them are connected. You release all these different chemicals, all kind of adrenaline, cortisol. Cortisol is what causes you to gain weight. It's a steroid. So if you constantly release steroids, it's not a wonder that you become obese based on, you know, stress. There's a lot of physiological issues, a lot of psychological issues. And that's why I think that we really need to start looking into psychology instead of just saying, we know. Oh, we know why these kids are bad. Yeah, they got bad parents. But why are the parents bad? Because the parents are dealing with the exact same consequences that they're creating in their children. So because the adult isn't aware that they need help, or they refuse to get the help that they need, they are having the same impact on the next generation and becoming a generational curse.
Now, let me ask you this question. Is psychology going to help the folks that are suffering from this low A score? Is psychology going to make them make better decisions?
Yes. If they work it. Now, if I know psychology and I walk up to somebody and they don't want to hear it, it's not going to help them. But if they take the time to do personal development, yes, all personal development is going to help you to develop personally. So if I have impulse control issues and I realize it, it's going to help me out. I'll give you an example. 4 years ago, you called me a bitch. I'm a swing off top. Ain't no ifs, ands, or buts about it. When I was a child, I was called out my name to a point I didn't like it. So I get older. I get stronger, I get bolder, I get much more aggressive. Now you call me a B, I can hold my own. Now it was people that called me out my name when I was a child and I was powerless to do anything about it. I'm an adult man now and I got the weight A. So when you call me out my name, I revert back to that itty bitty boy in the corner that was powerless. All that motion comes back. I don't have time to think about it. If somebody calls you, a white person calls you the N-word, you will swing or go off instant. You're not gonna think. You don't think about it.
Some people.
Psychology will help you become aware of that situation so that you can at least think before you swing. Do I have to swing? Am I mad at him? Is he even worth me swinging at? Or is it really somebody else from 30 years in the past that I have an issue with and I need to work it out with myself? Because you know what? That issue wasn't even really my problem. It was that person's problem. That person had an issue and took it out on me, and I suffered from it long enough, and now, you know what, I refuse to suffer from it anymore. So I'm not going to give any power to that word. That word has, psychology taught me that.
Yeah, let's, because we're getting into psychology, and what you're speaking on, and you spoke on earlier, was about violence. Now, what about education on violence? And education on what as America looks at as violence, based on what you can and can't get away with dealing in violence. Now, I took my Curry Casil class, so, you know, they break down the laws. So now I understand the laws. If somebody comes and calls me the N-word, I might not like it, but the fact of the matter is can I kill them because they called me the N-word? No, I can't. So if I can't kill you based on you calling me the N-word, there is no need for me to engage you physically. You should not engage somebody physically if you do not have the intention of killing that person or causing serious bodily injury. So if I'm not going to cause serious physical bodily injury, I'm not going to engage you. So when we start talking about assault and start talking about my freedom and understanding freedom and assault and understanding the prison industrial complex system and all that good stuff, the decisions that we make, good decisions or poor decisions, is what we can live by that can keep us out of being locked up and let us keep our freedom. So when you give them that education on what you can and what you will go to jail for, what you can go to jail for, what you can't go to jail for, what you'll be prosecuted on and what you won't be prosecuted on, that education over the psychology or sociology of it seems like that would also help.
You would think so, but it ain't stopped people from selling heroin.
But that's why I asked the question about the psychology of it. Will it help?
Yes.
Somebody make a better decision? Because
yes,
it's basically if you know why, it's a form of education.
It's definitely education. So if I tell you, you know, hey, every time I hear the B word, that's a trigger for me. Well, now I know that I get triggered by the B word. You feel me? So then I say, well, why do I feel that way? Okay, I feel disrespected. The word doesn't have any power. My thoughts about your thoughts behind using the word is what has the power. So then my thought is, he's trying to be disrespectful. People disrespect for me. I can't survive out here in this neighborhood because I've been surviving in a tough neighborhood for quite some time and I don't have the opportunity to be weak. So then people will say, hey, I'm going to go out here and commit assault, even though I know it's illegal. I'm going to shoot him. I'm not going to. And a lot of time it happens so quick. It's just instinctual, or almost instinctual, because of your subconscious as opposed to your conscious mind. We can reprogram our subconscious minds, but it takes time. That's what psychology comes into play. Otherwise, we're just going to keep on doing the same thing and creating the same cycles over and over and over again.
Because the truth of the matter is tough guys, one, don't live too long or don't stay free for too long. You know, if you have a trigger and somebody calls you something, you feel like disrespecting you is instant rage, instant anger. You know, you're going to, one, get a reputation if you don't get a charge. Once you get that reputation and people know how you are, they're going to definitely take precaution. So in the event that they feel the least bit slighted by you and they know that you're going to pop off, they're going to take it to the extreme from the fear of you taking it to the extreme. So that's one thing, like educationally wise, I like to talk to our people about knowing that. Being going 0 to 100 thinking it's a cool song isn't a real good defense mechanism.
It is.
No, it's not.
It is. On a biological level, it is. So biologically.
Okay.
Your cells reproduce and they have, I forgot, it's epimarkers or something, DNA epimarkers. There are certain things in your DNA that you can unlock. You know, you may not use it until you need it, but it's there. If you continue having these fight or flight reflexes, your body will cater to that fight or flight reflex and it will unlock the markers that make you a better fighter. So that 0 to 100 actually becomes, your brain is programmed to be 0 to 100 for survival.
But then
so much so that I know these little young knuckleheads in the neighborhood. I seen a dude with a gun in his face and he still was ready to fight.
So that's once again, you ready to fight somebody with a gun in your face. You're not going to win that fight. If you know any boxer that boxes, boxers don't get angry. They're very well trained. So you go 0 to 100 and you start swinging, you're not thinking, you're not rationalizing to where you're going to make a wrong mistake and you're going to end up and get knocked out.
That's so, called fight or flight reflex.
Well, but going 0
it's to... It's a reflex. You don't think about
0
it.
0 to 100.
0 to 100 is automatic.
So
you don't have an option. That's what I'm saying. You don't have an option in the 0 to 100. You have an option in the way you respond to the 0 to 100. But for instance, your daddy beats your mama and it burns you up every time your daddy. No, I'm not talking about the Dunn boys because we didn't have that. But so I'm just making an example. Just to clear the air. If your daddy's beating up your mama and you're sitting there watching it, you go into a fight or flight reflex. Anytime you see a man hitting a woman, you go into that same fight or flight reflex. You are going to have the increased heart rate. You are going to have the release of cortisol. You're going to have the release of all of this stuff, whether you like it or not. It's going to happen automatic.
But then what happens when you take that deep breath?
Well, that's, hey, but the issue is, who's teaching the deep breaths? We talking about 0 to 100 when I have a perceived threat, whether it's a real threat or not, it doesn't matter. Fear is false evidence of all things appearing real. So if I think it's real, it is. And you know, that's where it come from, but...
That's the education on a perceived threat and a real threat, which when it goes back to the education as far as what can you do when protecting yourself versus what can you do when protecting a loved one. But right now, we have some visitors.
Visitors?
Some visitors.
I didn't commission no visitors.
Some visitors in the booth. So we'd like for y'all to introduce yourself, if that's okay.
Well, hi, I'm so glad to be in the studio tonight. My name is Sherelle Roberts-Pierre, and I am Ronnie Bastin's campaign manager. He's a candidate for mayor. Thank you all for having us today.
And I'm Ronnie Baston. I'm the former police chief and commissioner of public safety. I'm a candidate for mayor, and I'm happy to be with you today.
Now, now, for the record, we are not bringing you on this show because you're a candidate for mayor.
That's right.
We are bringing you on this show because you are a resident expert in public safety. And as an ex-commissioner of public safety, I feel like that you can keep the public safe, so we're going to talk about it.
All right.
just got to put that out there for the universe.
We know how it is. And thank you. I know that you guys invited us to come on many, many weeks ago. So we're glad to be here. And thank you for that invite from several weeks back.
Glad to have you. So, where are we going with this, Mr. Mayor? That's the mayor, right? Yeah.
You know, there's been an awful lot of controversy based on the fact that I was seen walking in the community as a public servant to my people, and you being an ex-commissioner and police chief. You know, some folks don't understand where the connection is, because I've always been, I'm not going to say anti-police, but I've always been anti-police brutality, you know, and I have spoken verbally about that, and I speak out about that all the time. So what brought you into East End? You know, we was on Nelson, we was on Sharpshire, we was on 5th, you know, Breckenridge. What were you doing out there in the community?
Well, Brandon, I'm against police brutality the same as you are. And I want people to know who I am and what I stand for. I believe in doing what we can to make this community stronger and more united, where we work together and work on issues that we have. I want to put people before politics. And to do that, I've got to get out and hear what the people have to say.
Okay, and I definitely appreciate that.
Hey, do we have to do this professional?
No, oh, man, this is Blackout Radio, man.
All right, check this out, man. Hey.
This is Blackout Radio, man.
Okay, check this out. When it comes to hearing police issues, what role does the police department hold, and what role does the mayor and city council hold? Because for some reason, there's a concern that...
Let's be straight up. We're ready.
Let's
be straight up.
That's what I'm talking about.
We got Sherelle!
How are complaints against police department handled?
Well, complaints are handled. We have an Office of Professional Responsibility. So if a person complains...
Who is we?
Well, it used to be me. I'm not there now. But the police department has an Office of Professional Responsibility. And once a complaint's received, it can be an anonymous complaint. It can be a complaint that a person feels strongly enough about to come in and sign that complaint. Then it is investigated. And once the complaint is investigated, that information is given to the chief, who reviews the complaint and at the time makes a recommendation, calls the officer who's involved in, and if the chief believes that the conduct was inappropriate, he can make a recommendation to the officer. The officer can either take that recommendation or choose to go before a disciplinary review board, which is comprised of a bunch of police commanders and an attorney from the city sits on that group, as well as representation from the police union. And they hear the complaint and get all the facts, and then they make a recommendation to the chief as to whether they think the conduct was inappropriate or proper or unfounded. And then the chief reviews that and chooses whether or not to accept the recommendation. And, if the chief decides that their recommendation is appropriate, he can go with that. They can offer that to the officer. If they agree to take it, then the officer signs a letter of conformity, and then it's submitted to the law department, and it's read before the council. And ultimately, any discipline has to be approved by the council before the officer can actually take a suspension or anything like that. If the officer chooses not to take it, the recommendation, they then can have a hearing before the Urban County Council. And they can choose to either do that, and it's their choice, whether it's an open hearing to the public or whether it's closed hearing. You've seen some, I'm sure, open hearings that that the public's invited to. So that's the choice of the officer. Once the council hears that, and they usually hire an attorney that's outside of government to referee and run the hearing. So then once that's over, they have a finding, and then that finding could be appealed to circuit court if the officer doesn't agree with the finding.
Now, let me ask a real quick question. How many votes does the mayor get on council?
None. He's not a voting party. He's the mayor. He's a chairperson.
So if you
he's a figurehead, so to speak.
So you hold on.
For the council meeting.
So if it goes before the mayor doesn't get a vote?
It doesn't go before council.
If it goes before council, does the mayor get a vote?
The mayor does not vote. He's a facilitator.
So where's the conflict of interest? You controversy.
I mean, you want me to play devil's advocate? You want me to make something up?
Trying to figure out what the concept, you know.
I'm trying to figure out how come I didn't get to be the Red Power Ranger. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we can think about.
Well, we'd love y'all to just ask the question straight up.
Is there a conflict of interest?
There is not a conflict of interest. As police chief, I was responsible for the discipline of our men and women. Whether it was officer misconduct or formal complaint or anonymous information. And we took all of those very seriously. We held every officer to the same standard in an attempt to be fair. And as leader, it's really important that you show everyone, including the folks you lead, that you're going to be fair and apply the rules to everybody. And that's what I tried to do as police chief. As mayor, along with the council, we'll follow the procedures that are set up. We have to do that. Some of those are regulated by state law and the Police Officer Bill of Rights, which prescribes how police officers, the procedures that police officers have to go through to be disciplined. If there is any case where I feel like I'm in a conflict of interest situation, I will recuse myself from it. I'm not gonna stand there and put myself in a position where people are questioning, you know, why I'm deciding what I decide. If there's a possibility, any possibility of, you know, a conflict of interest, I take myself out of the equation.
Now let me ask you this. How long was you chief?
7 years.
How many of these cases did you hear? Because it goes to the chief first, right?
They do.
In your 7 years as the chief, the chief of Lexington Metro Police Department, how frequent are these type of cases or incidents?
Of complaints against officers?
Yeah.
Oh, we have several a year. And I dealt with a number of complaints, and I gave a lot of discipline, ranging from warnings to retraining to termination.
You made that comment fair. You know, I think it was in terms of police misconduct. Now, nationally, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on where unarmed people of color are being killed, women are being killed. So what steps have you taken? If you feel it's unfair now, what steps have you taken to make sure that there is justice and there is justice not only here, but nationally? Because I haven't even stepped out nationally, so I can't even say nationally. But what steps have you taken to make sure that there is fair treatment, especially here in Lexington?
Well, I can tell you what I did as police chief and what I'll continue to support. First of all, you have to get the right people into the police department. You have to recruit people who are there for the right reasons, who are there to serve and who want to help people. Sometimes some of the people who want to be police officers may want to be police officers for the wrong reasons. So it's our job to make sure that we appropriately screen people, watch them closely in the training environment, and make sure that they have the mindset and philosophy that we need here in Lexington and that we have come to expect. So selection of people, training people is very, very critical on the philosophy and what we expect and how we expect the job to be done and how we expect nothing but fairness to everyone in every situation that they go on. Anytime a complaint was brought or an issue was recognized, even by a fellow officer. Sometimes we got information from a fellow officer that, hey, the guy I went on it with this call is doing some stuff that's not right. And we look at it. We take it very seriously. And we encourage police officers to police each other. If they see someone doing something they shouldn't be doing, then that person could get a bad rap for all police officers. And we had a lot of that. We had a lot a lot of situations where information came from fellow officers about things that, you know, weren't right. And we took that very seriously. But I want you to know, too, that I am working on, I'm on a national committee with the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And it's called the Police Standards, Image, and Ethics Committee. And I've been on that for many years and have taken a very active role on that. And one of the things that we look at are issues, ethical issues, of what police officers stand for and what they should do and the conduct they should be doing, how they do their job. That's very important, extremely important. I'm also on a national, International Association of Chiefs of Police Policy Advisory Group. So we, that association sets policy for police departments internationally and especially nationwide. And so I'm one of about a dozen people who go and we review policies and we work on the writing and the wording, and we come back and we meet and then we agree on a policy before it's submitted as an international policy for that association. So I've been very involved with this work for a long time. I've tried to represent Lexington well, and I can tell you from the work that I do on a national basis and international basis, Lexington is a very progressive police department. And I think that's something that people should want to know and be proud of, because, you know, I talk to folks and see things all around the country, and I'm always proud to come home to the police department that we have.
Now, I will admit this. I give the police department hell on a regular basis. I ain't gonna lie. But I'm gonna tell you what, and I didn't realize it until I got pulled over in Louisville. Oh, everything changes. Once you leave Lexington, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but I will. I know how far to push it without getting myself in trouble or getting tased or, you know, whatever. I don't have the same feeling of comfort once I leave. Now, one thing, you know, we are well known in Lexington, but at the same time, I know that because of the situation that happened with Tony Sullivan 24 years ago, the Lexington Police Department is ahead of the game when it comes to the shootings of unarmed black men. You know, we've had an experience that two decades before everybody else even thought about it. And I feel like Lexington has learned from that. So I think that we have some freedoms, or that we experience some freedoms that other folks outside of Lexington don't have based on the police department. Now, I'm not saying that makes me a fan of the police department. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that, realistically speaking, that we don't deal with those issues. And I think that a lot of times it's easy to jump on a bandwagon of national trends and say, oh, they shooting people in California? Or are we talking about in Philadelphia? Are we talking about in Charlotte? Are we talking about... Because it didn't happen in Kentucky at all. You see what I'm saying? So I think a lot of times people jump in on that, and they focus on national issues, wanting to make the national issue a local issue, just to be, I guess, part of the larger movement. But I don't think that everything that happens in a national movement has a place in Lexington if that isn't a problem to begin with.
I agree with you, Corey. And, you know, we try to learn from some of the painful experiences we had as a police department. The Tony Sullivan incident really changed how we started thinking about training police officers and communicating with the public. You know, the late 1990s, when the racial profiling issue was very big, we learned from that pain as well. It was a tough time for both community and police department. And, you know, as a younger officer and a commander, one of the things I remember from that time was, in the early 1990s, crime was a big issue in the whole country. I think President Clinton, some would say, won is the presidential election based on the crime bill and adding 100,000 new police officers and some of those things. Communities all over the country were suffering, especially in some low socioeconomic areas. There were areas that had been neglected and hadn't been given the attention they should have. And so I think police departments across the country felt like they had a mandate to go in. There was an outcry from the community to come in. In Lexington, we were seeing crack cocaine. We started seeing drive-by shootings and some young people being shot. And it was scary for Lexington, Kentucky. And so the community was asking to come in and help with some of these serious issues. And as a police department and other departments across the country, I think we felt like we had a mandate and a calling to come in. So at the time, the chief, you know, had a strategy to come in and formed a special group to come in and work in some of the areas that were experiencing problems. And they used some tactics that were pretty aggressive, policing tactics. And, you know, most people, I think, understand if kids are being shot, they're willing to be inconvenienced for a short period of time if you can get the problem dealt with. But they don't want to live under aggressive policing tactics after the problems are better. And that's what I learned as a young police officer. And that's where we made a mistake here in Lexington, and people, departments across the country made the same mistake. We developed a mindset, I think, that this area or this piece of geography has to have an aggressive style of policing, and that's just not the case. No one wants to endure and live in an aggressive style of policing when they're not experiencing, when their kids are getting shot or they're experiencing really bad problems. The fact of the matter is, when you have really serious problems, sometimes there's just no magic to policing. We solve cases and we get progress the same old ways we have. You know, you have to have a lot of contacts with people to get information. You have to people have to tell you what they know about something and report it, or you can't be effective at getting it stopped. So in order to have more contacts, sometimes, you know, it has to be, there have to be more police and more opportunities to talk to people. So
and more community policing.
And much more of that.
I think that's something that we saw the other day. We were at a neighborhood meeting, and I don't want to mention the officer's name, but we were at a neighborhood meeting just visiting with the Georgetown Neighborhood Association and Miss Diane. So shout out, Miss Diane. But, you know, one of the things that was happening while we were there is the officer is doing community policing. He was trying to figure out how he could help the kids be able to play basketball, not in the street. And he wanted to create a little area for them to play basketball. And people will say, well, that's not the police's job. But you know, that's part of community policing. It's about getting out there and talking to people and seeing what they need. Well, maybe what they need is, you know, a place to play basketball so they're not in the street. Or maybe they need somebody to just check on them, you know, if they're elderly and can't get out, to make sure they're okay. And that's the sort of thing that when I was at the police department and Ronnie was at the police department, that we started to do was more community policing. And so I think that that's kind of where good policing is turning, where you're not just arresting people, but you're seeing how can you help them every day.
Well, that, you know, that's something, another thing that I learned. I spent a career treating the symptoms of crime by making arrests and those kinds of things. And, you know, we never seem to make much progress when we're just treating symptoms. And I feel very strongly that, you know, we're not going to make a lot of progress until we get to the point of asking tough questions and start dealing with some of the root causes of crime. And I think once we do that, we can get on a better path than we have been in the past.
And I got a real quick question for you. You know, the Bible, if you're a Christian, you know, you're supposed to hate what is bad. As a cop, you know, your job is to protect and serve and lock up bad guys. What's your thought on felons?
I'm sorry to hear.
What is your thought on felons? How do you feel about felons?
Well, I just came back from a program that I went to see in Chattanooga about 3 or 4 months ago, and to see what they're doing with some of the to deal with violent crime down there. They're experiencing a whole lot, having a real tough problem. One of the programs we got to learn about, though, I was pretty excited about, and I'd really like the opportunity to try here in Lexington. And they had what they called a felon job fair. And they went out and recruited businesses that would be willing to give people a second chance. And so they had a job fair, and they advertised that to people in the community who had records. And so everyone who had a record knew that if they came to that job fair, that the people who were there and had jobs available were willing to give someone a second chance if they had the skill sets that they were needing for that job. And they hit it. They said they were tremendously successful with that. And I think that's something we need to do here. People that have paid their dues need to have an opportunity to have a job. If we can't help them to do that, then, you know, it's very easy to default back to some of the old behaviors.
So what's up? We got a call on the line.
No, they hung up
again.
So I get to ask a question.
So don't be calling Black Out Radio and getting impatient and hanging up. If you want
to, you interrupted the conversation,
man. Hold your horses. We get you on her.
I got a question though. Let's talk about dope. You, just so you know, this is Black Out Radio. It's hot as heck in here, so you're currently sitting in the hot seat. No, I mean, seriously, we call it the hot seat. So you're in the hot seat, so we're going to ask you some hot seat questions. We're talking about dope. We're talking about heroin. You know, we live in a city that is in the middle of a heroin epidemic. What do you think is the most proactive and the most effective approach in dealing with the heroin epidemic that we are currently facing?
Well, I think it's going to take a community approach if we're going to be effective with heroin. I think we have to do, from a law enforcement perspective, I think there's a role there to try to reduce the supply and to try to hold people accountable that are making profit off of selling the poison and the dope to our kids and our family members and ruining families and their lives. We can help control supply with that to some degree, but we have to come together as a community to find resources that people can, treatment that they can go into, and then support people after they get out of the treatment to mentor them and keep them going. Narcan is a big thing that we have gotten into. Police carry it, I know now. Our ambulance service, when I was public safety commissioner, in 2016, I think we gave about 1,600 doses. We responded when people were dying and they were revived with Narcan, and we gave 1,600 doses of that. I think last year we exceeded 2,000 doses, so we increased the usage about 25%. We found ourselves last year giving more doses per patient because what they were running up against was much stronger than the basic heroin we'd seen in earlier years. So it took more doses of Narcan to revive the person and keep them alive. So it's a very serious problem. I don't know. I haven't talked to many families in Lexington that aren't affected by this in some way or another. And, we're going to have to work together with churches, community members, families. You can't arrest your way out of this for the folks who are addicted to heroin. We're going to have to work with them to help get them over that addiction.
We got a call on the line. What's up?
Yeah, this is the infamous Sarah Williams. Hello, everyone.
What's good?
I have a question for Bastion, specifically several questions, really, but we'll ask one. How do you feel about stop and frisk in your statements that you made, specifically about we don't need, an extra heavy kind of police presence here in the Bluegrass or in Lexington in particular? Because it seems to have come to several people's attention that there are several candidates for mayor that support increased stop and frisk. And research has shown that that's not super effective, and it also contributes to racial profiling. So will you, as someone seeking the office of mayor, support increased stop and frisk here in Lexington, or is that something you don't support, and why?
No, ma'am. I do not support stop and frisk. I think that's a bad tactic. We don't currently do that here in Lexington. What I support is getting out in the community and looking for opportunities to talk to people and having more contacts through community policing and ways that police officers can get out of their cruisers and talk to people.
Got anything else? Is she still on the line?
I'm still here. I mean, there were several things throughout the course of the conversation that came to mind. You know, and one thing that you stated, Officer Bastion, if you still go by that, is that you want to be fair, across the board, and how policing is carried out, or, as you take the office of mayor, possibly, in your candidacy. And I just wonder, for Operation Transformation that occurred in the East End area approximately 4 years ago with military equipment that the department had received, and it, was supposedly around drug activity and what have you, is that something that, if you all sought out enough leads, you would do in the white suburbs where heroin is such an epidemic?
I don't know what she's meaning. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear all the question. The microphone wasn't on.
Remember back in it was around the same time when Miss Anita started her first peace walk. They did a peace walk out through East End, mm-hmm. and it was on a Saturday. The following Thursday, they did a police raid and locked up like 55 people.
It was called Operation Transformation.
Yeah.
So are we going to have an Operation Transformation with military?
I remember doing an operation. There was some federal agencies involved.
Yeah.
And it may have been 2000. I can't remember the 14. Dates. They all run together
it's
now.
It's 2014, right maybe. Before my ground got killed.
Sound right? That time period, there was a lot of violence, especially in the 5th and Chestnut area, and that's where the operation was pretty well concentrated. And you know, we were hoping to do an operation with a program that was a national program from the national network, and we'd created partnerships with a local church and some others. And the philosophy behind that is you do undercover activity and you build cases, and then you do a roundup, and then you look for people in that group that you did the roundup with that are less sophisticated, that may be just kind of getting into the trade, and then you surround them as a community, and the you say
church, pastors,
but can we ever point to a time that the white community has been surrounded in such a way?
Yeah, and that's what we were looking for.
When statistics prove that whites and blacks,
so that operation,
the same race,
that was 2013 or 14, as I recall.
Did you hear her?
No,
we can't hear.
I can't hear.
You can't hear through the headphone.
No.
All right, cut that back on, cause we got like
cut what back on?
Two minutes left.
Oh.
Right. So, you know, the term was just used that in Operation Transformation, the community was surrounded. You know, statistically, the black community tends to be surrounded by military equipment both here in Lexington and across the country. So at what point will we be fair in the application of that, especially with the current heroin epidemic that affects the white community so deeply, and possibly surround the white community to address that issue? Will that ever be something that's considered in being fair across the board?
And I apologize. We're not quite hearing you, but I think, and you might not be hearing us clearly either, but what this operation is the word surrounding was not talking about police force. It was talking about surrounding people with services. So, for example, let's say that somebody has been getting in trouble. And so what this program says is, let's bring you in. Let's bring in your pastor. Let's bring your grandma. Let's bring your auntie. Let's bring in somebody who cares about you. Surround those people with love and support to try to get them out of trouble. That was the surrounding that this program was talking about.
Oh, and so that's in conjunction with surrounding the community with militarized police equipment, with military police equipment. So, you know, I think that I know that there are many people who have had black people in whatever community they live in within Lexington that have had continual experiences with the police department that have not been positive, and that have it has involved some form of prejudice and racism. And Bastion talked about he's part of a national board that deals with policy, and I think our history has shown us that policy doesn't necessarily change mindset and the actions that result from that. So I guess my next question would be, like, what has been done to change the mindset of the Lexington Police Department to dissipate some of the negative experiences that we as a black community tend to encounter on a rather regular basis?
Let me say this. None of us can deny that there haven't been negative relationships with the police over history. I think we have to acknowledge that, and I do. But we work very, very hard to try to overcome some of the history. And, you know, we have a wonderful police chief now whose heart is in the right place. I feel very good that he's going to lead the department in an exemplary fashion. And he's very aware of the history of policing and the importance of relationship with community. That's something I think that we've worked on very hard in Lexington and have made great progress. So, you know, I know Lawrence Weathers is going to do all he can do to build relationships within the community.
Hey, well, that's what's up, y'all. You know, we ran out of time. It's 7 o'clock, and we definitely out of here, man. Next, we're going to have to get you on, instead of being a specialist, we have to get you on as a candidate for office, and then we could really get to the real tough questions, and we can get way more callers in. It shows from 6 to 7. So the earlier you call, the more questions and more tough questions that y'all have, we'll be able to get to them. But we appreciate everybody listening to Blackout Radio with the Dumb Boys. We appreciate Miss Roberts and Mr. Bastion for coming in to the Blackout Radio. Corey, you got anything else before we get out of here?
Much love, peace, and blessings.
We out.
Thank you.